Today's episode of A Slice of Medieval. We have a very special guest joining us today. Derek and I are going to be talking with author Danielle Burton about her new book, Anthony Woodville, Sophisticate or Schema. You may have noticed that Derek and I both have an interest in Anthony Woodville and the Woodvilles at large, so we've been really looking forward to this episode. Danielle Burton has a keen interest in the Wars of the Roses from a very young age, including being a member of the Richard III Society since the age of 9. Wow! She has presented aspects of her research into the life of Anthony Woodville at various academic conferences and works in the heritage sector. So welcome this morning, Danny, to A Slice of Medieval.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for joining us. Like I said, Derek and I are both fans of Anthony Woodville, but what drew you to his story?
So, as you've kind of alluded to, I've been a member of the Richard III Society for 20 years this year, so I've kind of known about him through how his life ends and his connections with Richard III in that respect. But kind of to delve deeper into him, it all started about 9 years ago, when we took a visit to Pontefract Castle, me and my family. We probably hadn't been since I was very young, and I just said, can we, you know, go in the, you know, whilst we'd had a bit of time. And that is where Anthony sadly was executed in 1483. And there wasn't actually any information at all about, you know, what happened to him there at all. So I kind of asked the people that worked there, do you know anything at all, even if it was a case of whereabouts he might have been held in the castle, what conditions he might have been held in, you know, anything to do with his time there? And they just looked at me very blankly and said, we don't actually know who you're on about. So it kind of all started from there, really, because I was a little bit like, wait, hang on, this quite momentous event that led to Richard III becoming king, and you don't know anything about it. It kind of, like I said, kind of knowing that background already, it kind of in my head confused things a little bit as to why would nobody know about what had happened. So that kind of kick-started the whole researching into, well, why wouldn't people know? And then I kind of found out more about Anthony's life before his execution, and it kind of snowballed from there, really.
Yeah.
And this is your first book, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, so it's my debut book.
Well done.
It's very good.
It's very good, I have to say. I'm really enjoying reading it. I've only got about 50 pages left to read now. It's very good. So well done.
Good. Thank you.
I mean, Anthony Woodville is, as you say, he's a bit of a mystery to most people, I think. People have heard of Elizabeth, his sister, but if you asked anybody, who even people who are interested in history, and I suspect even those who have an interest in the period, most people probably wouldn't be able to tell you more than the one thing that you mentioned at the start, really. So obviously one of the things that's said about Anthony is that he rose to prominence in Edward's reign, Edward the Fourth's reign, because he was the brother of Edward's new wife, Elizabeth Woodville. But do you think he was the kind of guy who would have risen to prominence anyway, or was it solely down to that marriage?
I think it's a little bit of both, actually, because Anthony was very much, I think the reason why people don't know too much about him is that even though he is now the brother-in-law of Edward IV, he's not bothered in a lot of the political wranglings, which other people are at this period. He's not bothered about necessarily being Edward's right-hand man, although, to be honest, he is obviously still within his circle. You know, he's not that kind of politically ambitious person necessarily, but actually he was competent. So I think probably a bit more of his personality would have got in there, but not necessarily to the height that you might expect he would have had, you know, with Elizabeth's marriage to Edward. So I think there's a little bit of both there, that perhaps he would have possibly raised further than when the Woodville family start off, but not necessarily, you know, within that inner circle of Edward IV without that marriage.
Was he married to, was it Elizabeth Scales he married?
Yes,
was
that
married
was his
to
first
her
one.
Before the royal marriage or after or?
Yes, so the usual thing that's kind of thrown at the Woodvilles is obviously they are a massive family, and obviously on Elizabeth's marriage, that means that they all have to have quite prominent marriages as well. And that's usually a thing that's thrown at the Woodvilles for being quite scheming, which to a certain extent is kind of right. You know, they do end up making quite advantageous marriages. But actually for Anthony himself, we do know that he was definitely married to Elizabeth Scales prior to Elizabeth's marriage to Edward. So actually that one thing that's usually thrown at them, you definitely can't throw at Anthony, is he'd already been married by that point.
Yeah, and that did give him a bit of a leg up, didn't it, into the nobility, or at least, you know, the peerage.
To a certain extent, yes. So obviously he would have gone on to inherit his father's titles, but Elizabeth Scales was actually, she was the heiress to Lord Scales, who was, whilst he didn't have a big, you know, quite a big title, he wasn't an earl or a duke or anything like that. He was actually quite a wealthy landowner. So obviously this time period, as soon as Anthony marries Elizabeth Scales, he inherits her title. So of course there is that as well going on.
They were an old family as well, weren't they, the Scales?
Yes.
Seem to remember their name throughout the generations. So it would have been, it would have been a good marriage. Although he was only a baron, it was still an old baronage.
Yes, it was. And we do know that the Scales and the Woodvilles, even before Elizabeth and Anthony's marriage, they were actually quite friendly as well. They were fighting in the Hundred Years' War. They also fought in the Cage Rebellion together. Mm. So they do have the family connections as well. So there is quite a few different reasons why that marriage would have been made.
The first part of your title about Anthony Woodville is sophisticate. And I thought that was really appropriate because he was a diplomat, a soldier. I'm having to read this because it's a long list. A tournament champion and a poet. Was there anything Anthony Woodville was not good at?
That's actually kind of a hard question, really, because as you said, he gets so involved in so many different things that it is kind of hard to think, is there anything he's not necessarily good at? And actually, there's only a few instances that we can say that he did things that he probably shouldn't have done. So there is one instance particularly of his men actually took some stuff off a widow at this point, and that's probably about the only thing that he kind of puts a foot wrong in, really. And he does end up actually having a bit of an argument with Lord Hastings of the lieutenantship of Calais. So there is a few things like that where perhaps, you know, like us all, you know, we all make a few mistakes. So he's not exactly like he's a perfect human being, but actually in general he seems to be quite able at lots of different things at this period, which is actually quite unusual that you kind of at this period you kind of pigeonhole men into one camp or the other in terms of military skill, or maybe they are a little bit more of a man of letters at this point, which is starting to develop, you know, that idea. But actually Anty somehow manages to bridge the gap there very, very easily, actually, compared to possibly some of his peers.
I would suggest that one thing he's not very good at is politics, in that he doesn't see the axe coming, shall we say. He's maybe a bit too trusting.
Yes, I suppose there is that as well, because as I said, you know, the fact that he's not necessarily bothered too much about that aspect of it, he probably doesn't quite understand that other people really are into all of, you know, the goings on behind the scenes politically, you know, in terms of a bit of backbiting and all that sort of stuff that goes on in, you know, in the royal court. So yes, perhaps he's not so good at that.
I suppose he's had 13 years since 1471. He'd had 12 years of England being at relative peace. George, Duke of Clarence, had been executed, so he was out of the way, and he was the main schemer. So he probably just didn't see it coming, you know what I mean? Didn't expect there to be, because Edward V had been recognised throughout as Edward IV's heir, when he was Prince of Wales. So Anthony Woodville probably thought there might be a little bit of elbow shoving trying to get prominence, but he probably just didn't see that anyone would think of taking the throne from Edward V.
Yeah, I think the other thing is the suddenness of Edward IV's death. And I think nobody had all their ducks in a row, basically, because they weren't ready for it. And therefore, you get people doing things you wouldn't necessarily have expected them to do. So I don't think we can blame him too much for not seeing things coming, because nobody else did either.
No, and I do wonder if, because he was out of the way in at Ludlow, he didn't see the undercurrents that were happening in London and Midland, you know, like with Hastings writing to Richard and things like that. He was out of the way. He didn't, you know, he didn't know what deals were being made under the table.
Yeah, I'm not sure that many deals were being made, to be honest. I think it's all smoke and mirrors, apart from Hastings and Dorset being an idiot. You know, it's, yeah, it, as I say, I think it's the shock factor as well. So what were his best qualities then? What if you were assessing the man, what do you think everyone should know about him, I guess, really?
I think really the whole point is, like we kind of alluded to, that actually he did have a loyalty, which was to some extent quite unusual at this period, because everybody's swapping and changing during the Wars of the Roses. There's very much a sense of, are you Yorkist one minute and are you Lancastrian the next? Whereas, of course, obviously the Woodvilles did do that straight at the start when Edward IV became king, because as soon as he became king, they kind of, you know, left the Lancastrian side and they were Yorkists for, you know, the rest of that period. But actually he does have a loyalty, and he very much, you know, once he's in one camp, that's it. We kind of think, oh, it's a familial loyalty, particularly with the Woodvilles. And of course, the future Edward V is, you know, part Woodville. But actually, it's not just that, really. I think he's very much thinking what's going to be best for England's future at this point. Because obviously, we've had how many, you know, decades of war. You know, he's going to be the person to carry on, you know, this peace that Edward IV has set up. So there's also a bit of future proof in there, I suppose, as well. But actually, I think really, for me, we all have this idea of what a medieval knight really was, which probably doesn't live up to our fantasy ideas of what that is. But I think in a weird way, Anthony Woodville pretty much is that idea of what we've got. Somebody who is kind of fully immersed in all of the chivalric code, who is pretty much probably also involved in, you know, all the poetry and stuff that goes along with that. And obviously he's got the jousting prowess as well. So like I say, it's pretty much what I suppose, if you ask somebody today, what image do you have of who or what a medieval knight would look like? I would say that pretty much Anthony fits a lot of that stereotype. So I suppose in that respect, he's a very good example for that, because a lot of people in the medieval period and the 15th century don't actually add up to what we believe that image to be. But actually I do think Anthony Woodville fits it very well.
Yeah, and didn't I just read that in one of his books, one of the translations he did, he left out a passage because it was misogynistic, and Caxton commented on this, and I thought, good for you, Anthony Woodville.
Yes, exactly, because we kind of, that's how we imagine probably a medieval knight to be very respectful of women. That's kind of what we've inherited, really, which is probably not what we'd understand as what, you know, what we know is respect for women today. But actually, I can't imagine anybody else at this time period doing that. It's very unusual. Like you said, this is in the Dixon Saying of the Philosophers, which is actually the first known printed book in England with the date and place of publication. So actually, it's meant to be a moralistic text written, you know, with multiple sayings and theories, etc., from a lot of the ancient philosophers. So actually, if you just look at it as that, that's not necessarily the point, to get rid of misogynistic language. But Anthony Woodville's like, no, do you know what? That's not right. I'm not going to include that. And I find it even better that actually William Caxton, unless he'd have mentioned it, nobody probably would have known, because obviously it's the first English translation. So nobody would have probably known unless Caxton actually mentioned it.
And he mentioned it because he disapproves.
Yes.
He actually disapproves of Anthony.
Yes, and he's kind of saying he's going too far here. But, you know, but actually he goes, oh, well, actually, Anthony does respect women, so I can understand why he's done it, but I don't agree with it. That's kind of what Caxton's trying to say. So, yes, I think that, wow, I can't. And actually, his favourite, or one of his favourite authors that we do know of, is actually Christine de Pizan, who was also very early French female writer, who was actually professional because she was paid by the French court. She was actually what we probably call a proto-feminist, because obviously feminism didn't really exist in their time. But actually, you can see the connections really from what Anthony's reading as to why he makes that decision. So I think, as well as the fact he's surrounded by strong women, so he's probably gone, do you know what, I've seen what women can do, I don't agree with that. So I think there's quite a few different aspects of that.
He's quite his own man as well, isn't he, really? Because I was quite amused that he went off on a pilgrimage just after Edward had sort of restored control. And Edward wasn't very happy about it, I don't think. He's sort of, what are you doing? Where are you going? We've just sorted it out, you know.
Yeah, so actually it was that point. It was not quite a pilgrimage. He was asking to go on crusade, which again is completely not what's going on at this time period. That's a much earlier medieval concept. But yes, of course, the timing of it was really probably not good at all. because obviously Edward's only just been restored after being brought back from exile. And he's very much, Anthony's like, now, do you know what? I'm more bothered about my religious stuff here. Can I go and fight the Saracens? And obviously it's probably one of the only times that Edward called him a coward, which is actually kind of also says more about Edward, I think, because Anthony's been there with him in exile, helped him to regain his throne. He's been there fighting alongside him to do that. And then, yeah, again, he's probably not so good at knowing how well to time things either. But, you know, he's saying, look, I'm my own man here. I want to go and do this. It's for my religious benefit, you know. But we don't actually know 100% whether he did or he didn't go off and do it. Because we do know that the Paston letters say that John Paston was asked to go with Anthony and he was making preparations, but we don't have any evidence to say yes, he did or no, he didn't, other than the fact if he did go, that was around autumn 1471, and by the spring of 1472 he was out fighting in Brittany.
That's right.
May have been diverted if he did set off, he didn't get there.
But I mean, I think, I'm not sure Edward ever thought he was a coward, but he was just a bit cross about it, I think.
Yes, I don't think he believed it. He's just very much, like I said, more to do with the timing, and a little bit of Ed was like, yeah, you are.
Yeah, quite.
One black mark against Anthony, which I was very surprised at, was he was accused of cheating in a tournament against the Bastard of Burgundy.
Yeah, so again, this probably says more about the other person than Anthony himself. This tournament, the Smithfield tournament that this happened at, it was meant to be, so in this time, it's more, we completely imagine that it's more to do about training your military skills, that sort of thing. Whilst, of course, that is obviously a big part of what a tournament was. It's also, particularly in this example, a diplomatic thing. So the Smithfield tournament, it had actually been planned for 2 years, and it was part of the process of helping to negotiate the marriage of Margaret of York, Edward IV's youngest sister, to Charles, the future Duke of Burgundy. So it's kind of tied into all of that, really. And it ended up being 2 years in the making because, annoyingly, Antoine, we'll call him his French name not to get him confused, the Bastard of Burgundy, who is the illegitimate son of the Duke of Burgundy, he had been asked to take part in this tournament against Antony, you know, for these diplomatic reasons, but he had been actually busy fighting elsewhere, which is why it took so long to get there. But obviously, you know, massive, massive tournament to be taking part in, really. And, you know, the stakes are quite high in that respect, and it's meant to be all nice and friendly. And it kind of looks like that's how it's going to go, until all of a sudden the Bastard of Burgundy's horse is just spooked for no reason and kind of like tips him up. And he instantly goes, right, Anthony's cheated. Shouts it out to everybody, all of the audience watching, Anthony's cheated. That's how my horse has been spooked. But actually, Bastard of Burgundy had actually been, he actually did participate in a previous tournament with a German opponent who actually had cheated by hiding daggers in the horse's armour and all that sort of thing. So I think he seemed to think that something similar had gone off, but actually there was no evidence that that had happened. I think it was a little bit of paranoia as to what had happened before, because Anthony instantly went up to Edward IV and showed that his horse had got no concealed weapons at all. But obviously that kind of spoiled the tournament a bit, because there was that cheating allegation hanging over it. So they decided to kind of break off there and say, right, we'll go back to the hand-to-hand combat the next day. And they pretty much tried to beat the crap out of each other, as you can imagine. You know, this is a time when pure honour is called into question. It's a massive thing. So I can understand that there would have been quite a bit of tension going off. So, yes, obviously that had to be stopped because that was not the intention of this tournament. But, yes, it didn't really end quite so well as it had started with.
Was it always intended to be 2 days, or was it just 2 days because of what happened on the first day?
Most of the tournaments at this period would have been multiple days, and it would have been a mixture of the jousting and the hand-to-hand combat. But actually, it ended up being cut short because at the end of the second day, they found out that the Duke of Burgundy had died. So obviously that disrupted things.
Put a damper on proceedings.
Yes.
And of course, they'd had another tournament when Margaret of Burgundy did marry Charles, didn't they? But they kept Anthony and Antoine apart at that one. They weren't allowed to fight each other.
Yes, yes. They'd said at the end of the Smithfield tournament, we'd better not fight each other again after what had all happened. So yes, they ended up fighting other people at that particular tournament.
It does interest me that this guy is kind of, as you said, an all-rounder, isn't he? He's good at everything. He gets involved in everything, and he's competent. I use the word competent, which I think is interesting, because often there are people in this period who are given high office and big responsibilities, and the one thing they lack is competence. And we see that happening in the Wars of the Roses a lot. But he's a reliable, he's a safe pair of hands, basically, for Edward IV, isn't he?
Yes, yeah, I think that's the easiest way to explain it, really, which is another reason why you kind of think a little bit, oh, wow, he really doesn't want to get involved in the political wranglings of things. But actually, he's proved he is a competent and well-educated person to be able to do these things. But he's just not bothered about the nepotism side of it, which is what other people are bothered about and how they end up, obviously, in those offices. He's just more bothered about doing what he wants to do. So, again, that's quite unusual.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, one of the big things, and you've touched on it already, is his relationship with Caxton, and obviously a very important development in terms of the history of printing in England. Can you tell us about his relationship with William Caxton? Where did they meet, and how did it all start?
Yeah, so before William Caxton became the famous book printer that we know him as, he actually started off life as an English merchant. So that's kind of how he probably got into contact with the whole printing development, really. That's kind of how he came to it, really. And he actually was a merchant out in Burgundy, particularly in Bruges. So he actually rose to prominence within the merchant community, and actually he was the head of the English merchant community out in Bruges. So we kind of think that that's sort of how that connection is made, because Anthony went out into exile in Bruges with Edward IV after the brief restoration of Henry VI. It's either that or when the marriage with Margaret of York is developing, because obviously the English community would have played quite a part in the marriage celebrations.
Yeah.
So it's one or the other is how they've probably got to know one another, come connected in some way, because actually Margaret of York did actually end up being William Caxton's first patron when he became a printer, and that's where he started to print, was actually in Burgundy. So there is possibly some sort of connection through that, really. And then when Caxton decides to set up in London, he actually straight off goes and sets his printing shop up in Westminster, which suggests that he's probably already got some sort of connection to know exactly where his audience is going to be. And obviously Westminster, you've got the royalty and the nobility, you've got Parliament, you've also got the religious aspects. So he's quite obviously very already au fait with whoever is going to be his audience. So that's kind of how his business starts in London. And Anthony does become his patron. And like I said, it's probably through him that he kind of knows where to set up and who to have the connections with, because obviously he's interested in all of the book stuff that, you know, he inherited a lot of that interest from both of his parents. So he kind of must have said, there's this need now. You know, Europe started to develop their printing businesses quite well at this point. England hadn't got that yet. So it must have been some sort of channel in that respect. But actually, Anthony was not just his patron, he was also his translator, which is also what we've alluded to, which is again completely unusual. You know, it's more common for people just to go, right, can I be your patron, and I like the sound of this book, can you make that for me? Whereas Anthony is completely and utterly involved in the process of this. We know that he's translated at least for Caxton, and they are some of his earliest examples that are produced in England, and they are all kind of moralistic, chivalric, you know, the kind of things that you'd expect Anthony to be producing with Caxton. But actually, that was Caxton's main aims, because of who is you know, producing these things for is obviously mostly the nobility and you know, the upper middle classes, you know, the people who can kind of afford this new technology,
people who can read.
Yes, of course, if they can read. But the whole point is he's translating it into English. You know, these are some of the first English texts, and Anthony is right in the middle translating these from French, from Latin. So obviously, of course, that means he's very good at his languages as well, which, you know, was very helpful.
It's difficult now to get a sense of the impact of printed books and pamphlets and so on, isn't it? Because it's such an obvious part of the world for us. It's difficult to grasp how it would have been received by the courtiers and other people in Westminster, the ability to be able to read multiple copies of this particular piece of work.
Yeah, so it is. It's also hard to know because not a lot of examples survive actually either. So it is even more difficult to understand how people thought and felt about these things was not something that was recorded necessarily. So again, it's hard to kind of judge from our point of view just how big a thing it probably was, really.
Yeah.
But we do know that, particularly when, you know, we know that Edward IV is growing his own library at this point, mainly through his connections that he's made in his exile, because they stayed with Louis, Lord of Cruthers, who was the Duke of Burgundy's representative in Bruges. And he was actually known for having possibly the biggest library in Europe. So we do know, we have examples of like these massive royal libraries, you know, that kind of idea. But sadly, we don't really know how much further it filtered down, even though obviously we know that that probably meant more nobility, more possibly upper classes, if they could read, would be, you know, buying this sort of stuff. But we don't really 100% understand how that kind of correlation works necessarily, sadly. But, you know, obviously, you know, compared to monks making their own versions in, you know, printed, illuminated manuscripts, that's still quite a massive technological advancement in itself, really. And obviously that meant that these early printers, they must have been absolutely skilled and having to pretty much train people in a brand new technology, just very much like how we do deal with a lot of AI and, you know, computer stuff that's coming out now. It must have been, in that respect, very similar, just you're dealing with a different type of technology.
Yeah, and also I think they were still doing illuminated manuscripts. So they were doing an illuminated manuscript edition, which I suppose would be the equivalent to our hardback, and then the printed editions that they could, you know, how many printed editions could they get off in the time it takes to write, to copy out an illuminated manuscript edition?
Yes, yeah.
And I guess it, for the kind of upper middle classes, for the sort of socially mobile merchant class and so on, having printed books, starting your own library, was something of a status symbol, or became something of a status symbol. But that must have taken time to evolve, presumably.
Yes, I'm sure it would have done. But as Sharon said, you would have still had, obviously, the illuminated manuscripts at the same time. So possibly you could own the manuscript version and the printed copy, if you so wished. And we do know that that probably happened with the Dixon Sayings of the Philosophers, because the illuminated manuscript version does still survive, and it's in Lambeth Palace now. And actually, that is the only image, contemporary image that we have of Anthony Woodville, is actually the illuminated manuscript version, as it's basically an image of Anthony presenting that copy to Edward IV with Elizabeth Woodville and Edward V, still then Prince of Wales, as well. So actually, you know, it does kind of show very easily that, you know, whilst of course it's the new technology, that those two things would have still actually existed together.
Quite a good way, in a sense, for him to be remembered, to be represented.
Yeah, it's appropriate for him, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Another side effect of William Caxton's printing press was that Anthony Woodville actually commissioned books to help with the education of the Prince of Wales. And Anthony, of course, was in charge. He was the guardian or the governor of the Prince of Wales?
Governor is the official title,
How much influence did he have on the future Edward V?
Yeah, so as you've alluded to, there was kind of a bit of a cycle going off there that he's obviously the patron of William Caxton, but actually a lot of these texts are going to be used for the education of the future king. And we do know definitely that that happened, as the history of Troy, that is actually specifically dedicated to the education of the Prince of Wales. So we do know that that obviously that connection would have influenced the educational side of this young prince. But in general, Anthony Woodville would have had quite an influence over how this young Prince Edward would have grown up, because Edward IV drew up quite a long 11-point list of rules as to how his young son would grow up, you know, what kind of environment he would be living in. And actually, Anthony Woodville is the only named person in that list. So it's very much obvious from that Edward IV is going, I completely and utterly trust Anthony to carry out all of these rules. The bit that I find the most intriguing, but also slightly most hilarious part of this, is the fact that Edward IV is pretty much saying his young son should grow up in a religious, moral way. You know, he should not be surrounded by people that pretty much do the things that Edward IV partakes in. So, like, no womanizing, no bad language, no mass drinking, all that sort of stuff that we all know Edward IV did partake in. So I think it's very much like, I know I'm not the person to look after my own son, but actually Anthony Woodville's probably the best person to leave, you know, my son in the hands of. So I think that actually says quite a lot, that Edward IV himself is going, you know, he has to grow up in a way that means that he's an all-rounder, because it's at that time, although we understand that more of a Renaissance humanist style education, we now understand that more to have come in with the Tudors. But actually, Anthony Woodville is right at the forefront of that, you know, so actually having access to all of the things that Caxton is producing is going to be a huge help to that. But actually, if you think about it, being holed up in Ludlow, away from his own family, Anthony Woodville, whilst he's his uncle, is probably the closest thing that poor Edward had to a real father, because although obviously they'd have spent time, you know, Christmas times, all that sort of stuff together, that Anthony Woodville is the main man that he's actually surrounded by pretty much all the time.
Yeah. Have you come across Nicholas Orme's papers on Edward V's education at all? If you haven't.
Yes, yes.
Well worth looking at.
Yes, it is. It's very good at kind of explaining a little bit more in more depth as to hopefully what that kind of setup would have been.
Yeah. What amused me is that there were two sets of, as I'm sure you know, there were two sets of ordinances. There was the set of ordinances that were written when Edward V was a very small child. And then about 10 years later, there was another lot of ordinances which clearly indicated that Edward had been going slightly off the rails, because that's where all these things about don't do this, don't do that, only do this, only do that. All those ordinances came in then, because basically he was into his teens, or nearly into his teens, and clearly he was his father's son. So it was very interesting to come across that. But yeah, as you say, I mean, the man was Anthony Woodville. He was the one controlling that whole upbringing. I've heard it said, I mean, it's been said, you see, I'm sure, as you know, there's so much said about the Woodvilles on the internet. It's just not true. Well, most of it isn't true. But one of the things that somebody said once was, why on earth did Edward IV choose a Woodville to be the governor of his son? And I'm thinking, you've got Anthony Woodville and all the things we've said about him. Why on earth wouldn't you choose him? He's the obvious ideal choice.
This is another reason that actually kind of, when I first started all of this research, like you said, you have kind of a stereotype in your head as to what Woodville is. Whether you like it or not, you have that stereotype, because it's just been going, doing the rounds for 400 or 500 years. But actually, really, out of them all, Anthony's the one that doesn't actually fit what, you know, that grasping, ambitious, probably, stereotype at all. I think really that's all the Woodvilles, particularly, as we've kind of alluded to before, Dorset, completely and utterly fits that model.
Yeah.
But actually, Anthony doesn't.
No.
That's partly what fueled me into writing this, really, because whilst, of course, he has the Woodville name, he doesn't really fit what people would expect him to fit in, really, at all in that respect.
I think it's one of the tragedies of the period is that Anthony Woodville didn't live longer and isn't seen as one of the greatest men of his age, because I think he should be, really.
Mm.
Yes, I agree, although I am obviously very biased in that. But yes, I think it's, again, it comes down to the fact that because he didn't get involved in all those political wranglings, that meant in a way he was a background figure, but in a weird way he's not, because he's the one that's fueling a lot of the culture around what we know of the 15th century. So, you know, he's very much, Edward IV kind of says, right, I want a new version of Camelot.
Yeah.
And actually, Anthony Woodfield's the guy making that happen in a weird sort of way, whereas Edward IV probably, as much as he would love to think that he was, he wasn't.
Yeah, so I mean, it's all going swimmingly, and then the wheels fall off. So again, all manner of rumours abound on the internet and elsewhere in printed form about what happened in April 1483 between Anthony Woodville and Richard Duke of Gloucester. I think we can probably agree that there was no long-standing animosity between the two. So what do you think went wrong? What happened when they met up on the way to London?
I blame a lot of this on Edward IV dying just before he's 41, really. Obviously, that means that, you know, there's, you know, nobody expected that to happen. I can imagine that it just came pretty left field for most of the people at that time. So that obviously meant that he had a 12-year-old son now being proclaimed king, which, as history tells us, is not a good place to be in, sadly. you know, having a boy king doesn't generally tend to end very well. So obviously, a lot of fear, a lot of chaos is probably going on behind the scenes, really, although obviously there's a bit of, like you said, smoke and mirrors. Oh yeah, everything's fine, but it's obviously not really for a lot of people behind the scenes. But as we've said, you know, they were pretty much, I wouldn't say best friends, but they were on friendly terms, because they were within Edward IV's circle. They had, you know, gone to exile with him. They would have been around each other quite a lot. Although actually, really, they were actually very similar personalities, I think, as well. That they both pretty much valued loyalty at a time when, like I said, it's not really a given. They both kind of stayed out of things quite a lot towards the build-up of 1483. So, again, you know, actually they are quite similar in that respect. So it kind of does come quite left field that out of nowhere, you know, there's this agreement that, you know, around about 2,000 men should be used to help bring Edward V to London safely, because obviously, you know, you've got to protect the king in this, you know, it's quite a long journey to make. So again, there's still compromise going on till almost the very last minute at this point. And it's agreed that they should meet at Northampton and then continue to London together. Because whilst Edward IV's will doesn't survive, we believe that he said that Richard Duke of Gloucester should be protector. So obviously that means that they have to work together to get the now young king to London. And again, this is where things all get quite murky, really. The myth goes that they met that instead of staying at Northampton, all of these men decided to go to Stony Stratford. And Northampton was quite a large medieval town, famous for shoemaking, still is. So it probably would have had enough houses and inns and etc. to billet these people on. But the excuse was that it wasn't big enough, so they moved on to Stony Stratford, which is pretty much minuscule in comparison. So it's like I said, it all gets quite murky, and what do you believe and what do you not believe at this particular point. But actually, Annette Carson's put forward what I think is quite a believable theory, that actually Northamptonshire is the Woodville's heartlands. That's where, you know, a lot of their lands are. And she suggests that Grafton Regis, which was obviously their main home, is actually kind of in that vicinity. So was a perceived threat because they'd actually housed him at Grafton, probably for no other reason other than to keep him safe. But obviously to outsiders, that probably would have looked quite dodgy, you know, that they are kind of holding this king in their lands. But actually, Anthony did what he was asked to do. He actually did meet Richard at Northampton, probably alone, if not with his old nephew, Richard Grey, who was one of Elizabeth Woodville's sons from her first marriage. And they met as friends. So again, even at that point, there is no question that everything's still going all right at this point. Then the next morning, Anthony, as well as Richard Grey and Thomas Vaughan, who was the young prince's chamberlain, they were all arrested, saying, personally, I think what's changed is there's a lot of people, you know, spreading rumours And, you know, in a time of fear, you know, there's a gap of information going off. Things like that can quickly snowball. And I think that's pretty much what happened, that there are some people, other people, particularly Hastings and the Duke of Buckingham, who are all going, right, here is our chance to kind of either consolidate what we already had or get somewhere where we haven't before. You know, because it's a new regime, like I said, everything's been put into chaos. It's the time for people to try and make their claim, really. So I think that's what's happened, that there's other people who've got in the mix.
It's very unusual, though. It's very unusual. It's almost unheard of in English medieval history, because normally you get jockeying for position. That's totally normal at this sort of kind of juncture. And the leading players will be trying to protect their corner and get as much influence with the young king as possible. Totally normal. But it doesn't normally result in this kind of problem, particularly between two courtiers who, as you've said, were on at least, at the very least, on good terms and trusted each other. You either look at it one way or the other. Either the arrest of Woodville and the others was planned in advance and happened to be done the following morning, or it was a kind of reaction, a kind of knee jerk. There's no other way it can. It's either one of those.
Yeah.
So which of those two do you think it falls into, probably?
Personally, I think more of the knee jerk reaction, because like I said, there's no evidence to suggest that there was any planning. It does seem to be very much off the cuff. And kind of the thing that changed at that point was the arrival of the Duke of Buckingham between that, the met his friends, and, you know, the arrests. And he's one of the people that is very much at this time trying to get up the ladder, because Edward IV gave him nothing. He didn't actually trust him, which again is very much like, well, why would you if he has actually intervened in anything? But yes, I think there is also, you know, there's this discussion of, was there or wasn't there a Woodville plot at this point? And again, you could say one way or the other, there is or there isn't, because it's, like I said, everything's so really quite complicated at this particular juncture. But if there was, I think it was very much possibly other Woodvilles, Dorset, that were more likely to have had the means and the opportunity and the personality to have done it. So actually, I do think it's probably more of a reaction. And sadly, Anthony Woodville was the one there to get, compared to others. And obviously, you know, at this point, if there was one, I don't think that he would have necessarily known about it, because as we said, he was pretty much in the bubble in Ludlow, away from things. And again, you know, he's already proved in a way that he's not involved in anything, because why, if there was a Woodville plot, would you go to Richard without any guards?
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, he'd just press on to London and get there first and get the boy crowned before Richard could do anything.
Yeah, exactly. The last thing you'd do if you were plotting to ensure Edward was your king is to stop and go and talk to someone who you might regard as a major rival. It doesn't make any sense at all. I think you're right that Buckingham's involved. I mean, Hastings wasn't there. No. Hastings had merely lit the fuse, basically. He was still in London. But the arrival of Buckingham, and you're right, Edward IV had given Buckingham nothing. Edward IV was a fantastic judge of people. So given that he'd given Buckingham nothing, that tells us, that shouts from the rooftops for me about what Buckingham was like. And I mentioned before the word competent, and that's not a word I'd apply to Buckingham.
No.
Chocolate teapot I might apply to Buckingham. But so I think, yeah, I'm sure you've got a point there that Buckingham's arrival is significant. How significant, you know, we'll never know.
And of course, Buckingham at this time was married to a Woodville, wasn't he? Catherine Woodville.
Yes, he was. But actually, I think he very much saw that as forced upon him, and he did not like that at all. He very much felt that he was forced to marry somebody beneath him. So I think there is also a bit more of context to that. And actually, as he proved later on under Richard III, he was very, very good at plotting himself, which is what ended his, you know, that was his demise. So I think if you look later on, he has obviously got a bit of form.
Yeah, I'd argue he is completely useless at plotting along with everything else, because otherwise he wouldn't have
died.
Which
is why he ended up with his head separated from his body.
Yeah, I think the marriage to Catherine Woodville, personally, there's not a lot of evidence about his views on the subject. And I think it's not that he was marrying a Woodville, it's that he didn't get the influence he expected marrying a Woodville
Mm.
to get him with Edward the Fourth. And it's that disillusionment, and well, he was in a bit of a hump, really. He was not happy, not happy bunny.
He wasn't so upset with the marriage that he abandoned Catherine. They had 5 children or something. You know, he must have been fairly content in the marriage. They didn't live separate lives.
No.
No.
It's another one of those things that whole thing about Catherine Woodville's marriage, it gathers momentum from more or less nothing,
yeah.
really.
Yeah.
As you said, the Woodvilles have got a reputation, and that's part of it. But yeah, Richard's motives throughout that period are difficult to decipher. And the only thing that always annoys me a bit is that people say, oh, well, because we don't know anything, anything is possible. Well, that is complete rubbish. I mean, anything's not possible. Certain things are possible, but it's become a bit more muddled, I think, because all manner of suggestions are made about who did what and why, with no evidence whatsoever, but just simply the fact of the lack of evidence. So I guess it was like that at the time as well.
Yeah, I don't think we appreciate how much confusion would have been caused for them as well.
Yeah, definitely.
So, Danny, have you caught the writing bug? Have you got a new project in the works?
I have an idea for the next writing project, and it's right at the very, very beginning of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that will hopefully develop into the next book. But like I said, it's very, very much at the beginning. So we shall see about that. And if it does develop any further, it's actually not on the Wars of the Roses anymore. It's actually on the Stuarts.
All right. Okay.
Oh, good. Yeah. I like the Stuarts. I haven't done it. It's one of my least strong periods in history. I did the Civil Wars at university for a little while, but not a lot. So I don't do a lot of the Stuarts, but my son loves the British Civil War, so I've been covering it through him.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating period that is very underrepresented, probably because it comes just after the Tudors.
This is what I say all along. Tudors have got probably pretty much everything going for them. I think people overinflate them. It's just like, there's all interesting stuff before and after them, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. Definitely, yeah. We would totally agree with you there.
Yep, definitely.
Well, we do go rogue occasionally and do periods outside the medieval period. So
yeah.
if your idea comes to fruition, then we'll probably be knocking on your door to see what it's all about.
I'm hoping yes. It will do, so fingers crossed.
Thank you very much for talking to us today, Danielle Burton. I do recommend our listeners get a hold of the book, Anthony Woodville, Sophisticate or Schemer. It's an excellent read. I love the way it actually focuses on Anthony rather than Edward IV and Elizabeth Woodville.
Yeah.
It gives you a different insight into the period.
Good, yes, that's what I was hoping, because everybody always knows about Edward IV and Elizabeth. And it's, yeah, there's as much as they are obviously the linchpin of this period, I think Anthony's fascinating in his own right.
Yeah, it shifts the emphasis. I think it really gives a different flavour to the period as well, which anybody studying it really should look at. So well done with that.
Thank you.
Yes, definitely. Thank you very much, Danielle.
Thank you very much.
Do join us next time when we will be talking with historian Nathan Amin about the House of Beaufort. I'm looking forward to that one. I've been Sharon Bennett Connolly.
And I'm Derek Burks. Do subscribe to avoid missing a podcast. If you enjoyed it, perhaps give it a like. We'd love to have a rating or a review from you. Join us next time.